We come to the sixth presentation in the Major 2012 series, and we're looking at Hermetic Bodhisattvas who are cosmic guides. And the Hermetic is from the Western, the Bodhisattvas from the Eastern, and they're related. And both of them emerge out of the same context, out of Alexandria, out of the dedicated community of what used to be called in the 19th century seekers. In the 20th century, they were called healers. In the ancient Greek, they were called therapeutai, which meant that they healed by contemplation, that they were able to shift the dimensions of the world by adding a quintessential transforming fifth dimension. And that fifth dimension was vision. And that the visionary quality adds like a thumb to the hand and makes it prehensile, so that one can refine one's ability to shape and to configure things in space-time. That contemplative dimension was also evident most clearly in a change in life, that life became something that was healed in the sense that health returned to the phenomenal physicality of someone, but that they were prepared for a further transform, so that there was a second transform, which was a refinement of the first transform. And the ancient way to talk about it was in terms of alchemy. The first was a fermentation. The second was a distillation. And the easiest way, time-honored way, is to understand that the fermentation made a wine, the distillation made what we would call the cognac or the champagne. It took 1,000 years before anyone understood how to distill a potable liqueur. Early alchemy, you would die if you tried to imbibe what was coming out of the beakers. And in France, because the French have always been absolutely dedicated to finding something even more potable, the monks of Chartreuse made the world's first liquor about 1,000 years ago, and it's still for sale. There are two kinds. One is green, which you have to be very careful. If you sip more than a thimbleful, you will find yourself on the floor. There's a yellow Chartreuse that they cut it down by a certain amount so that the nuns could also celebrate. The distillation comes because vision refines itself into history. And so vision and history are two transforms. And they work not only to transform ahead, but they recursively reconfigure what was before. And so the future and the new past are symmetrical. They relate. And they relate because there are transform pivots, vision and history, that allow for new forms to occur that were hidden in the world before. Not only hidden in the world before, but hidden in the universe before. Vision transforms so that instead of just having forms that are integral in the world, you get a third kind of a form. You get a form that is differential rather than integral. And the first differential form is the artistic spirit person. The second, the distillation that comes out of the historical activity, the kaleidoscopic activity of spiritual persons in their prismatic, their ability to have a whole spectrum that develops, is that the second form, different from the universe, is our cosmos. So that a cosmos has twice as many dimensions as a universe. A universe only has four, space-time. And it's characterized by something which is indexable because it is limited technically. The universe is indexable by number, by an arithmetic series of functions. And one then can understand, you can prorate arithmetic numerology and so forth, and as long as you stay in space-time in the universe, it becomes quite accurate. But there is a transform. The early Pythagoreans called it theoretical arithmetic, visionary arithmetic, which transcended the numbers, the arithmetic limits, and became a mathematic. And a mathematic is able to have an infinite number of new functions. You can, somebody said about 20 years ago in the early 1990s, we have just published more books this year than all the books on mathematics ever printed in the whole world. That the mathematical field was blossoming and has considered 1990 as a kind of a watershed, because every year since then it has also asymptotically increased, because the power of computation has asymptotically increased. And when one looks at the indexing numericality of computers, it turns out to be a pair, a byte, a bit, zero and one, that they work together in such a way that if you speed up their time, increase their frequency of energy, one can begin to compute almost anything indefinitely refined. So that there is an alchemy, not only of things in the world, but there's an alchemy of the future of differentially conscious forms, because they're generated not out of the zero base of nature so much, but out of the infinite field of consciousness. And this in ancient times, how ancient? 4,000 years ago. A genius from Central Asia, born and raised around where Samarkand is today, whose family were involved in long caravan routes that went from Central Asia all the way over the Hindu Kush into the Gobi Desert, and along the southern rim of the Gobi Desert all the way into China, 2,000 years before, 2,000 BC, before 0 BC, 4,000 years ago from our time. That family had a genius whose name was Zarathustra. Zarathustra. Zarathustra means good with camels, because the family ran enormous caravan routes. And one of the caravan routes that they began to explore was a sideline that didn't go following the Amu Darya River into the big passes through Tajikistan, dropping down into the Sinkiang area of what is today China, into the Gobi Desert, but another route that came south and went over a 12,700-foot pass and dropped down into what is today Afghanistan. And the most fertile, powerful kingdom 4,000 years ago was centered around what is today Kabul. And that genius, Zarathustra, fell in love with the daughter of the king of ancient Afghanistan and married her and discovered that that family extended were especially close to him, like his wife, understanding him, and he came up with what translates as a phrase, noble friends, that there is such a thing as a man of light who is rare because he occurs out of what usually is the talent pool of masculinity, the men of action, the men who get things done. But the man of light is a transformer, is able to not just teach, but to give a guidance by having a new kind of language form. And that new kind of language facilitates vision. It facilitates the transition from a mind that has an integral structure to a visionary field that has a differential capability. And that transfer goes through a membrane of language. As long as language is just mythic in its horizon, has images which have feelings, which integrate together and are able to be held mentally by symbols, one has a cycle that is quite complete. But the transform introduces other dimensions. Beyond completeness, there is perfection. And when one moves into the transforms of perfection, you begin to get a different quality, not only of dimensions, but especially of time. Time no longer is just the first dimension of energy, but something else comes into play, which is clumsily characterized as timelessness, but it isn't timelessness at all. It's eternity. And eternity is not capable of having a numeracy, not capable of being characterized. And so when one comes to the original writing that came because the extension from Kabul went through the Khyber Pass into northwest India, what is today the Peshawar Valley of Pakistan, by about 1500, after 500 years, that population of people developed their own version of Zarathustra's original language, which was Avesta. And the Avestan in India, 500 years later, generated Sanskrit. And what was different was that the Avestan was the original written language in Central Asia that spawned, after 500 years, not only Sanskrit in India, but spawned at the same time Old Persian in Iran. And so you get this kind of a spreading around 1500 BC. And the spreading was not just that there was a new offshoot of written language. The Sanskrit is the first offshoot from Avestan and a whole family of languages called the Indo-European languages came out of this. We're speaking English, which is thousands of years later, a refinement of the original Indo-European language. It can not only be spoken, it can be written. And when you have a written language, those who can write find that their learning capacity becomes unlimited. And those that can read that writing find that their learning capacity is tripled. The ability to learn is already twice, but the thrice greatest is that you are able to write. If you can read, you can learn. If you can write, you can teach. And the ability then to teach ourselves, because we are able to write and read and interchange in these double fermentation and distillation, and we discover that we can write in many different ways, not just many different languages, like Avestan, Sanskrit, Chinese, English, but we can write in new transformed symbols. We can write in mathematical symbols that can be read as not as meta languages, but as parayana languages. They're the way beyond. And not only that, in our own time, those of us who are a little bit older, in the late 1940s, one of the geniuses from the Manhattan Atomic Bomb Project was Richard Feynman. And he was trying to be a good professor at Caltech, and to after his experiences teaching at Cornell, he decided that the Caltech students needed to have a new way to write the mathematics. And so he invented a whole new language, Feynman diagrams, that is an original, new, written language that anyone can quickly come to understand. It looks like squiggles that come together and then squiggles that go apart. And in that kind of an X hourglass shape of interchange, one understands that there is such a thing as not having to untie the knots of ignorance, but of reconfiguring the way in which you conceive it so that you get bows instead of knots, and that the bows have the great function that you can continuously reopen them and reopen them, and at each reopening, you get a new surprise, a new present. So that one now has an ability to understand elements of the cosmos that are so small and so fleeting that they become more ephemeral than ghosts or phantoms used to be in the old mythology, and yet they are real, can be understood, can be communicated. Here is an excerpt from the first Prajna, that's wisdom, Prajna Paramita Sutra. And it is called the Prajna Paramita Ratna Guna Samkhya Gatha. It's not a sutra, but a gatha, because Zarathustra's writings were called gathas. And of his gathas, there are 16 yasnas that make up four gathas. The first gatha has a series of seven yasnas. The second gatha has four, the third has four, and the fourth has one. And the final gatha, which has only one yasna, fits in with the first seven and makes an eight shape. And that eight shape is a flow that has a continuity to it. The two middle gathas, each with four yasnas, which make a second eight, are able to be characterized fundamentally in an exactness of an integral, whereas the first seven and the final one, that eight, are characterized the way a genius 2,500 years ago put it. The genius was in India, and he became the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. And the Buddha, in describing an atomic moment of thought, a citta, said there are eight phases that can be characterized definitely in a moment of thought, but there are eight others that cannot be characterized at all definitely. He said 2,500 years ago, it translates that they occur as a trill, but that the trill does not register, so that a moment of thought is also a byte. It's a bit of zero and one, each one made up of an octave, an octode, an eight-part structure. And one of the Caltech geniuses that was trying to upstage Feynman at Caltech was Murray Gell-Mann, and he came out with the noble eightfold way of understanding quarks that make up things like protons and neutrons. And next week I'll bring a copy of his original book. If we are able to understand that a differential consciousness with more dimensions than the universe has is able to mature itself through learning and to express itself differentially through another second transform, you get a third level, a third stage, if you want, a third kind of form, if you want, that did not occur before in the universe, didn't become apparent even in the cosmos, but now functions quite adequately in a third level. And we call that third level now hyperspace, which has 10 dimensions. And a 10-dimensional hyperspace is the way in which interstellar civilizations communicate and work. You can't find them on trying to find radio stations. Not even of trying to find psychic channelers. Hyperspace is literally dimensions beyond the cosmos, because it has both an integral and a differential complementarity that is able to be characterized. And some 2,000 years ago in India, because of being seeded by a very special man, he was an architect. He was from what is today Damascus. He was Syrian. His original language was Syriac, but he was international in his practice. Even then, he was wonderful in Greek and Latin, and Hebrew, and Aramaic, and his name was Didymus Judas Thomas, who became Saint Thomas, who went to India in 41 AD, and he followed the ancient path, the seaman's shortcut, by going down the Red Sea to the mouth of the Indian Ocean to the island of Socotra. And there on that island, just before the monsoon season hits, there are special winds that blow across the Indian Ocean and go into a direct diagonal from Socotra to the southern tip of India, to the eastern part of it, and that's called the Malabar Coast. And that particular journey was very refined 2,000 years ago because the first person to ever utilized it 1,500 years before St. Thomas was able to go that way. And the first person to utilize it was Queen Hatshepsut of Egypt. She was brilliant, and having learned that you can send ships once a year to India, to the southern tip, and then bring them back at the end of the monsoon season. In India, there are six seasons. There's summer, the rains, and autumn. Then there's winter, early spring, and then spring. And if you go at the beginning of the rains, you can go to India, and after the rains are finished, you can come back the same route to Socotra, up the Red Sea, to Egypt, to up the Gulf of Aqaba, and one can have communication. The fulcrum was that Socotra was the interchange point, but the country that ran Socotra was what we call today ancient Ethiopia and ancient Yemen. The one was called Sheba, the other Sana, and the kingdom that was astride of that became exceedingly wealthy, but the population was a mixture of Indians and Africans. Africans and Indians making Ethiopians. And the queen, about 1000 BC, was the queen of Sheba. And she was brilliant and rich and intellectually incredible. And she heard of the wisdom of Solomon. So she had one of her great caravan routes run itself to Jerusalem so that she could meet this wise Solomon and see just how wise he was. And of course, they fell in love. The thing about Thomas was that when he went to the Malabar coast, he carried with him a special invitation from a king in northern India, his name was Gandhafares, to build him a temple that would be the most glorious in the world. Just like Solomon was going to build a temple that was the most glorious in the world in his time. The man who sent Thomas was Jesus, who taught him that the high architecture is on more dimensions than just mortar and stone. That one goes into at least eight dimensions of a cosmic type of community for prismatic persons. And so when Thomas, landing on the Malabar coast and then taking shipping up along the western coast of India, up the Indus River into what then was called Gandhara, he met Gandhafares, who gave him an enormous amount of money to build him a beautiful castle, a beautiful temple, a place that would be the center show place in the world. And they had good examples of special showcases because 300 some years before, Alexander the Great had infected them with the idea that one can have really world-class empires. And when Alexander left India, there was a brilliant man named Chandragupta Maurya who set up the Mauryan Empire to be like Alexander's, only to be in India. And Gandhafares was the inheritor of that Mauryan brilliancy. But when Thomas came with all the money that Gandhafares gave him, he gave it all away over the period of about a year. So that when Gandhafares came back from his annual conquest exploration, he said, "Where's the temple?" And St. Thomas gestured, "You're surrounded by it." So he was thrown into jail. And while he was in jail, Gandhifaris found out that he was the most beloved king ever, that everyone respected him, and that Thomas indeed had built the right temple for him. And so Thomas gave the wise man of those days in Gandhara the teachings of a special way beyond. And the way beyond was the way of perfection. Not the completeness of control, not the completeness of empire, but the infinity of love and of dedication, of being guided by a man of light who will always be there, who has a community of noble friends that renew itself from generation to generation, that the men of action can learn from, can tune to, so that the population of human life then becomes refined. This is something. This is chapter 22 of the Prajnaparamita Ratnaguna Samkhya Gatha, written about the time that St. John was writing his gospel in the late 60s AD. Therefore then, the learned who has slain pride, who seeks with weighty resolution for the best enlightenment, should, as one attends upon a physician, to be cured of a multitude of ailments, attend upon the good friend undaunted. The Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas who have set out for the best enlightenment, and those who have perfections, have been enumerated as the good friends. For it is they who trust them, i.e. the Bodhisattvas, in these progressive stages for a double reason. They understand the Buddha enlightenment, the past and future, they use the term here, jhanas, which means the victorious, and those who stand just now in all the 10 directions in the universe. If one thinks of 10 directions, one thinks of the coordinates, then the middles, then an axis of going through, up and down. But in the way beyond, in the Parayana, in the great way, the Mahayana, the ascent is an infinity sign and its ancient symbol was the caduceus of Hermes Trismegistus. Whereas the ascent is like an infinity sign that's open, the single pivot is what is below, so that the hand holding the hermetic scepter holds infinity above and the exactness of the universe below, so that the axis has an ability to have a special kind of a rotation. It has what is called, in physics, a magnetic chirality. It is able to rotate clockwise and anti-clockwise at the same time. If you rotate clockwise and anti-clockwise at the same time, you get in the universe a motionless equanimity. In the cosmos, you get a high frequency dynamic. And in hyperspace, you get the ability to move without effort anywhere in time, anywhere in space, anywhere in prismatic personhood, anywhere in history. Let's take a little break. Let's come back to the way in which there are long-term resonances that establish themselves in sets, so that it's not so much that there are long-term resonances, is that there are harmonics that are permanent. And those permanent harmonics not only reoccur, but as they tend to reoccur, they accrue all the energy that they had gained and emerge new on a more energetic level. The slow energetic rise is like the evolution in the universe. A speeded up energy rise is when you get a species like ourselves that is able to generate cultures. In Kenya, Louis Leakey, who was born in Kenya of missionary parents, so that he grew up with the Kikuyu tribe, and he called himself a white African. When he finally went away to university in England, it was the first time that he realized that he didn't dream in English, he dreamed in Kikuyu. And he learned, he was the first person in tens of thousands of years who learned how to chip rock and make spear points. And he could do it like in a minute. And he said, there was a hominid species before us, Homo erectus, that was wonderful. They spread themselves almost everywhere in the Eurasian world. And he said they made brilliant spear points, but stupidly, they never improved them in a million years. When a culture becomes able to begin to improve itself, it more and more becomes able to have intercultural or multicultural ways in which their developments begin to interchange. And about 6,000 years ago, that developed itself into a new form, the form of civilization. The proto-form was based on cities, so habitually we call it civilization, civitas. It's based on cities. But civilization is not based on cities. The prototype was, but the actual archetype is based on language. And so one gets the energy of language becoming more and more capable, so that 6,000 years ago, when the first written languages came out, it got super energized 2,000 years later when the first written languages came out. And now in our time, we have the first infinite language, not just of computers, but of our ability to not only transcend psychically psychology, but to yet again go beyond psychic into something new. The time forms, and they're plural, there are three in civilization, have been condensing and raising their energy so that in our time, we have the energy to become a whole star system species. Our star system stretches out so that a diameter of it would be almost, if you went out to the far heliopause phases of it, almost a light year across. That there should be bickering and fighting over territory, over cultural insistences. At this stage, a doctor of civilization would diagnose it as madness. But it has a peculiar, particular kind of madness. 2,000 years ago, the first visitors to Joseph and Mary when Jesus was born were three magi from Iran who knew by constellation mechanics that someone special was being born exactly then, exactly where. And they brought gold, frankincense, and myrrh because they also understood that this was a new harbinger of a new time form. So the gold, frankincense, and myrrh were to finance their secret going to another place to live until the danger more or less would pass. Those three magi came because the double millennium aeon time form before them in 2000 BC, the constellating pair were Abraham and Zarathustra. So you had someone who founded the promised land, literally founded it in Hebron. He bought the field of Machpelah, which had caves, and so he could bury his kin. And it's still there in Hebron. Abraham is buried there. His wife Sarah is buried there. His son Isaac is buried there. Isaac's wife Rebecca is buried there. They're still there 4,000 years ago. That Iran, whose renaissance came because of a revival of Zarathustra as Zoroaster, about 500 BC, that they should be close to a nuclear Armageddon now shows that there's not only a madness, but that there is a epidemic blindness as to what constitutes and constellates ourselves, all of civilization. It's important for us to begin to understand that the interrelationality 2,000 years ago, paired as Hermetic bodhisattvas, paired as ancient India doing a fermentation from the Hindu religion into Buddhism, and then having a distillation of Buddhism into the Mahayana, the way of the bodhisattvas, at the very same time that the Alexandrian Greco-Egyptian fermentation of ancient Egyptian wisdom got a distillation into the Hermetic, all at the very same time. The cue to it is that there was a triad, a reaching out to the far east and to the far west on the pivot of Alexandria. And the far west, the reach was to the west country of Britain, to Somerset. And there, for three generations, the health of the far west of this triad of the transforms of civilization was extremely healthy, and then it suffered tragedy. And the tragedy formed itself around the kidnapping of a royal wife of a king, so that that king literally went mad with grief, left his kingdom, which was the Irish Sea coasts, Ireland, southern Scotland, the Midlands, Wales. His name was Lir. In Gaelic, it's spelled a little bit different, L-Y-R-R, and Welsh, L-L-Y-R. In Scottish, L-E-I-R, in what turned out to be English, L-E-A-R, King Lear, who fled to Kin, who no longer lived on the south part of the Irish Sea coast, which is Cornwall. He went to a part of what is today France called Brittany, because their language is very much like Cornish. They were kin to the Britons, so they called it Brittany. And you can read the tragedy of Shakespeare's King Lear, of what happened to him there, because he carried the fracture with him. And the fracture stayed because his kidnapped, appropriated wife, her name was Penarddin. In ancient Cornish, it means the royal lady of the hill. She was the daughter of a queen, a very great, powerful queen, whose name was Anna. And Anna was the daughter of a very beautiful, important woman, and her name was Susanna. And Susanna was one of the four sisters of Jesus. And Susanna's daughter Anna was the only female born to the Holy Family. She was the only one that carried the mitochondrial DNA. Doesn't take a Da Vinci Code. It takes understanding, civilization. Anna married a king who was so graceful and mighty. They use the appropriate word there, King Belémoir, like Bryn Mawr, Belémoir, the good, gracious king. And they not only had Anna, but they had two sons. And those two sons became, Lud became the king of Britain, and the other one, his name is pronounced Louis, even though it's spelled different in ancient language, he became the king of France. So Anna had the king of future king of England as a son, the future king of France as a son, and the daughter who became the queen of the whole Irish Sea kingdom. And she passed on the mitochondrial DNA to Penarddin, who then had three children. She had two boys and a daughter. The daughter was Penarddin. The oldest son was named Bran. Bran is famous. And here in 1895, published in London, The Voyage of Bran. They say son of Feeble, because Feeble was the name of the man who kidnapped his mother. Not only that, she was forced to be a captive all her life, the rest of her life, to him, and forced to have two sons. One was called Nisan, who was very bland, and the other was permanently evil. The Voyage of Bran, in the Land of the Living, an old Irish saga now first edited with translation, notes, and glossary by Kuno Meyer. Kuno Meyer was a German genius intellectual who fell in love with the Celts and with the Irish lady, and he became the first person to be able to put together not only the voyage of Bran, with an essay by Alfred Nutt, whose brother David Nutt was the publisher of these very expensive, it was called the Grimm Library, G-R-I-M-M. And it's a second volume, The Celtic Doctrine of Rebirth, The Transformation, the whole development, because when Penarddin, who had a daughter named Branwen, she was given in marriage to an Irish king, who, when the people found out the heritage that had happened to her mother, they made up stories, and she became a Cinderella in reverse. She went from being the honored queen to being the washer of dishes. She trained a little sparrow that mythically flew off and alerted her older brother, Bran, to come and rescue her, which he finally did. But she was so heartbroken at what had happened that she died of heartbreak. That family had in its keeping the relic of the cup of the Last Supper. It wasn't that Susanna had it, but one of her sisters, Mary, had it because they owned the house in Jerusalem where the Last Supper was held. Mary's husband was named Cleophas, and he had a brother named Barnabas, and they ran the trading ports on Cyprus. And they had a single child, they had a son. They named him a family name, John, but he's always known by his second name, Mark, the future Saint Mark, who was about 10 years old at the Last Supper. But he was the one who carried the water that you mix with the thick grape wine syrup to make the drinkable portable wine. So later on, he was always identified by the sign of a water jug. He was the water carrier for the Last Supper. He was the page, literally. He was about 10 years old at that time. St. John was 2 years older. He was 12 at that time. So they were young. And Jesus was their uncle. Not only the uncle of John and Mark, but the uncle of James as well, because James and John were both sons of the oldest sister of Jesus named Salome, who got her name and her education because she was born while the family was in Alexandria waiting for Herod to die. He died in 4 BC. They went in 9 BC, so they were there for about 5 years. So that a lot of the infant stories of the young Jesus start when he's 5. And one of the stories is that they were going to send him to school, and he refused to be there. And the apocryphal story is that he was told that he had to learn everything from Alpha through Omega. You have to learn the whole course. And he said, if you can tell me what Alpha really is, I will tell you what Omega really is. And so they took him out of that kind of school. And the father, Joseph, who was an architect, not just a carpenter, which meant that not only could he build everything, all kinds of things, up to including temples, if he had to. But he also had contacts with raising the trees, and the trees were in the forests of Lebanon. And those trees from the mountains of Lebanon were taken down to a city called Sidon, where the ancient Phoenician shipbuilding was at a very high art. And then those ships from Sidon were taken to Tyre, which was the commercial hub of the Phoenicians for about 2,000 years. It's the Phoenicians from Tyre that founded Carthage in 800 BC. They founded Marseille in 600 BC. They went through the Straits of Gibraltar before Solomon was even born, all the way down the coasts of Africa as far as the Cameroon, and all the way up to the what became the British Isles. So that those Phoenicians out of Tyre were enormously capable. And they had special connections because when Alexander conquered Phoenicia, and the last fortress that there was to conquer was Tyre, and the way he did it, because Tyre was built on an island off the coast, so it was very difficult to get a mass of soldiers there, and they were the best seamen in the world, so you couldn't have a naval assault on them. Alexander built a rock mole out from the mainland to the island and sent his troops over, his legions, and they conquered Tyre. So when he got to Egypt, when he got to the delta and he saw the island of Pharos, he envisioned building a mole out to Pharos and having Alexandria, this city, which would be the new world city. So the Tyrians and the Alexandrians were close for centuries and centuries and centuries. And the ancient Egyptians had all the contacts with India and Africa. So that between Alexandria and Tyre, there was a swath from India to Ireland that those few families controlled. They were not banking families, they were the families that owned the banking families. They were the intercontinental traders 2,000 years ago. It's interesting because at that time there was not only a revival of the lineage from Abraham down to Jesus, but there was a revival of the Magi in their lineage coming from Zarathustra for 2,000 years down to those Magi who came to witness and seal, triple seal, and confirm that a new time form had occurred. And that when the new time form came into play, it made the old time form lose energy in the sense that it slowly became diseased. And as it went on, without shifting to the new time form, the disease deepened into madness. We live at a time where we are now 21 years into a new time form, and those who are still trying to enforce an old time form have passed from disease into madness. They carry with them death. The madness of the old time form surfaced in 39 AD. And even before that, when Tiberius was older, he had been a dutiful son, adopted son. He was the son of Livia, who was the second wife of Augustus. And he turned absolutely mad with superstition. His only hope lay in getting an astrologer who could tell him truthfully what was going to happen so that he could have some handle or control. So he would take prospective astrologers to his estate on Capri, where there was a tower. And he would say, "Let's go up to the tower." And there he had soldiers ready to kill the astrologer, until finally one of them said, "You're taking me to kill me." And he became the astrologer. But that was right at the end where Tiberius sank into an evil madness and killed both of his brilliant sons, who were ready to take over the kingdom. And very soon after that, he became literally eaten from the inside out by maggots. That was 37 AD. The next Roman emperor was Caligula, who became crazy as soon as he got the power, and who became evil within a year, and who became absolutely mad in the second year of a 3.5-year reign. Nobody else was able to hold the emperorship of Rome with any kind of sanity for almost the next 100 years. Not only did the Caesars go crazy with Nero, but the Flavians grew crazy with the final son, Domitian. His reign was called the Terror. And then there was a period where almost nobody could take over the Roman Empire. We're in the same kind of world where those who are trying to tyrannize by enforcing energies, forms, styles of personality without any vision, without any history, without any energy to maintain their health, jeopardize life itself. Because we are capable now not only of Xing ourselves out, but by injuring the genome of all life on the planet. So these are serious matters. The only spectrum that will work is a spectrum that translates into an infinite vision that is able to carry any number of prismatic persons into whatever combinations they need to enter into to be able to generate whatever kind of kaleidoscopic histories, plural, many times over, that will allow for a cosmic analytic to really work. So all of this is interesting because last week we talked about how the Hermetic and the Bodhisattvas became wobbly and unstable because of the tragedy that happened in the Far West. And not only that, but the Far East became inured again in such a way that its instability was that the Mahayana, instead of being a great vision that was infinite, it began to split into sects. S-E-C-T-S. And so what would have been the great vision, the Mahayana, became sect after sect after sect. And an attempt was made about 1,000 years into it, at the end of the first millennium, to try to reconstitute the original great way, the original Mahayana, and that was to develop it into the Vajrayana, the diamond way. And pursuant to that, there were two sutras that were written about that time, written and published. One of them was the Diamond Sutra, which was the first printed book in the world, about 900 AD, printed on blocks. Wood blocks. The other was the Heart Sutra, the Hri Daya Sutra. And those two were meant to be a symmetry pair that would bring the Mahayana into a Vajrayana new distillation level. The genius at that time was Milarepa. He's calling now. You can always tell when I'm getting to something important, there's always an interruption. It's quite interesting. Those who, and many of you have been following this for decades, so you're acquainted with it. You understand. Let's come back to something. We talked about the yoga and the yajna last week, that the Hermetic is a very high yoga, not the Hermetic tradition, but the Hermetica are dialogues. They're dramatic dialogues that raise the yoga to a thrice greatest level. There's a natural level, there's a visionary level, then there's a historical level of transform. The natural transform is not in nature, but in myth. The ability to bring language, spoken language, into sequences of stories that are characterized by not a line so much, but by an arc. That there's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end. And that one can extend the complexity of experience generating mythic horizon by linking many arcs together and making either a circle or a cycle, so that then one would have a mythology. But what's important is that that yoga is able to be twice refined. The yajna originally was a sacrifice. And the sacrifice, because it was modeled on the ancient Zarathustran. And the ancient Zarathustran was that there were towers of having a sacred fire at the top. And that sacred fire at the top was the place in which the sacrifice was offered to the openness of the transforming possible. In India, the early Vedic civilization was all based on the ability to have a refining fire. And in Sanskrit, the divine figure of that refining fire is Agni. So that the Agni yajna was the central sacrificial ceremony in India. Next week I'll bring some materials and show you that the base upon which it was conducted were large blocks that made an eagle. And a new structure was built of sacrifice, and that eventually this became the super sacrificial fire, because at the end of a long, many days ceremony, the whole thing was burnt down. And in that conflagrational quality, it meant that the sacrifice was successful in sending out that energy, that radiation. In our time, in the 20th century, it took a long time for the refinement to come through. The yajna was distilled from a sacrificial fire to a sacrificial journey, to a pilgrimage. And the first karma yogi of that new refinement was Mahatma Gandhi. And he did it in 1930. The tyranny of being taxed for every little thing extended down to the lowest possible gouging of even the beggars. There was a tax put on salt. So Gandhi transformed the yajna of sacrifice into the yajna of a pilgrimage of sacrifice to initiate the powers of Satyagraha. And he marched from his ashram, Sabarmati River in near across the river from Ahmedabad, where all the big fabric factories were located, and his little ashram was right there across the way. Everyone was supporting him. He marched from there to the sea at the little fishing village port of Dandi, and he went into the Indian Ocean, and he scooped up some water and let it dry in the sun, and it left sea salt. And so tens of millions of Indians began going to the seashore and making their own salt. The distillation of that came in 1951, 3 years after Gandhi had been assassinated. His number one satyagrahi was named Vinoba, Vinoba Bhave. When he came to Gandhi, Gandhi said, "You are Bhima, you're like a giant. I want you to go to the center of India, establish an ashram, and wait there until I call you." This was in 1921. And he waited there for 20 years, studying and learning every language in the world, reading the Quran in Arabic, reading the New Testament in Greek, reading the Old Testament in Hebrew. He was a universal genius. In 1951, he began his yajna, which was walking all over India ceaselessly until he found a way to alleviate the poverty of the 700,000 villages of India. And he initiated the distillation of satyagraha into sarvodaya, means the for all the people. He went to a village where it was distorted by two brothers who between them owned the village. And Vinoba sat with them and said, "I want both of you to adopt me as one of your sons, but I want you to give me my portion of my heritage now, and I will put it into a trust fund for the untouchables." By the time April 1951 was over, he had collected 12,000 acres, and within another month, 18,000 acres, and founded Sarvodaya so that the yajna now became a pilgrimage to help all through a satyagraha holding and a sarvodaya harmonic to match the highest yoga, which was a raja yoga. This yoga is a maha raja yoga. More next week.